we're mixing it up a little bit this time with some, I guess you might hear this down in the bayous of Louisiana. This is another episode of Inside Bassmaster. This is your host, Thomas Allen, and joining me this week, we've got a lot of big personalities in studio, and the one and only, the editor of Bass Times, Brian Brasher, is going to sit in.
I'm here. I'm
glad you're here. And then, of course, the man that keeps his finger constantly hovering over the master control switch at Bassmaster.com, the vice president, Jim Sexton, got his numbers down on paper. Glad you're here. There's a microphone there somewhere on your desk.
I do see it. Thank you for setting me up.
And our special guest this week is none other than Bassmaster Elite Series veteran pro, Brian Snowden. Brian, thanks for being here and being a part of this.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're glad. We got a lot of stuff to talk about. We want to dig into your history and keep your credit card and Social Security number handy, and we'll hit up Bass Pro Shops and see what we can come away with. But So we've got a brand new season ahead of us, a different look to the Elite Series. We've got an exciting schedule, and we're going to get into a lot of that. But before we dig deep into your past as an angler, Jim has spent some time looking at your statistics, your years as a pro, and I know that he's eager to get into those. So I'm going to turn it over to him, and we're going to hear about your record.
All right.
Well, it's great to be here with you, Brian. He's telling us this morning that he drove down with Chad Morgenthaler from Missouri. They live in the same neighborhood.
Hmm. We have, we got quite a few professional anglers in that area, and Chad saw where I lived, and he just had to move in. So now it's
that's great because he just moved in a few years ago, right?
He did. Yeah, he's probably been in there now about 3.5.
Built
years.
A house, mm-hmm. I think. And yes. How long have you been there?
We're going on 8 years now. Okay. I've been in the Reed Springs area though for about 11 or 12.
Okay, where did you grow up, Brian?
I grew up in Sunny, California.
Is that right? I've forgotten that.
A lot of people do. I guess, I seem more of a Missouri native than a California guy. But I grew up in California, and that's kind of where I fell in love with fishing with my dad and grandparents. They always took me and was just out there this year for Christmas.
Wow. What age did you move to Missouri?
I was actually my junior year of college.
Okay. And what motivated that move?
I moved here because I wanted to be a professional angler, and I thought you needed a great sponsor, and there was only one Bass Pro at the time. So I moved from California. I was going to Fresno State, and I transferred to Missouri State, and kind of fell in love with the Springfield area, a lot of great lakes within an hour and a half drive, and that's where Bass Pro was. So I started working for them part-time when I was going to college, and then I actually worked for them for 5 or 6 years full-time when I graduated. Mm.
And they remain an important sponsor for you.
Yes, they've been with me for my entire career, and I hope that continues.
Wow. That's awesome. That's fantastic. At Fresno State, did you finish a degree? Or you finished it in Missouri?
Yes, I finished in Missouri. I have a biology degree.
Another biologist on the Elite Series.
Interesting. Yeah, I wish I could. That's one thing I would have done over. Everything else pretty much stayed the same, but I would have definitely got a marketing degree.
Okay, interesting. We've got Mark Menendez that's a biologist. And I'm trying to think. It seems like there's one. Steve Kennedy's not a biologist. He's has an engineering degree. But you'd think he's a biologist.
He knows a little bit about everything.
Yeah, he does. He does indeed.
A lot more college degrees floating around out there on the Elite Series today than there have been in the past, it seems like. And that's a good thing.
Well, there's a lot of business degrees. It's interesting. It's almost like they planned for it.
Well, yes, and I think that would have helped me. I had to learn, through trial and error how to do the marketing. Bass Pro worked with me a lot, and a lot of my other sponsors have as well. But, that's still one of the things I'm learning constantly, and I think that degree would have been very beneficial, especially dealing with, larger non-endemic companies.
So a couple of numbers for you. Brian, you're 46.
Mm-hmm.
And married?
Married.
Yep. How long married?
20 years.
20 years. Wow. Congratulations.
Congrats on that.
Yeah. Good for her.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Luckily, I found a really nice one.
How important is your wife to your career?
The family support, I think, for all the anglers, myself included, is one of the things that is... you have to have that to be able to be gone like we are. You have to have mm-hmm. someone that is willing to sacrifice her own personal time to maintain the house, pay the bills, do the things that we need to do, help you when you're on the road, travel with you, do those kind of things that they all do, and it's all kind of behind the scenes. And they definitely don't get the kudos that they deserve,
right,
because her support over the years through the rough times, you know.
Yeah.
We spent a lot of times, I can remember being stuck at Santee Cooper and almost missed the takeoff one morning on the, I think it was the top 150s, but the van, we were staying in the van. It didn't rain for like a week straight. And, you know, so it's a muddy mess in the campground, but we're living in this conversion van that I have. And, you know, her to get up and get someone to come and tow the van out of the mud, get me launched, and I still made takeoff in time. So
wow.
Things like that, you know, you have a great time when you're doing it, but those are memories that, you know, you keep and cherish because of all those times you spent together.
Right.
So was the decision to be a pro bass fisherman already made when you guys met? I mean, did you know that was your career path?
Right, and that was she was already conditioned to me being gone and fishing all the time. So,
all right.
Yeah, I was doing it full, you know, all already, and we'd actually had some classes in college, but we didn't actually start dating until we had both graduated.
Okay. I always wonder what that conversation must be like when you tell your wife, your future wife, yeah, I'm going to be a pro fisherman. I mean, some people are taken aback by it, I'm sure.
Well, I know it took her parents a little time to warm up to the idea.
And, you know, the in-laws would be the one I would expect.
That's
to be
a conversation.
Taken aback.
Yeah, they're they have a farm in northern Missouri where we're cattle farmers, and now he leases out his land. But when she first told him that, he was kind of taken aback. But now, you know, it's amazing what a nice hat will do, or a jacket or something that you bring. He wears it to the coffee shop, and all the guys love to talk to him you know, their son-in-law that fishes for a living.
Great. That's fantastic.
Well, it doesn't always start that way, and I'm sure that there are, you know, as you entered into the career that you were going after, there were ups and downs, and you know, you talked about the van situation, but tell us another story that's kind of that realm, something that transpired you weren't expecting, that, you know, you guys both came out smelling like roses, but maybe it didn't start out that way. Was there a tournament that you're doing well at and bombed, or what was it?
Well, I've had a few close calls, you know, where, you know, I was really thinking I was going to win an event, and situations, you know, weather change, moving to a different body of water, kind of, you know, put the damper on the actual victory. But, you know, it's been a victory for me to be able to do something that I love. You know, every time I think about a regular job where you don't have the freedom we have, and the things you get to do and see throughout the United States, I mean, when we travel on the Elite Series, I've been everywhere. I've fished everywhere I've ever really wanted to fish, and then some places that, you know, were very unique fisheries. And to get to do that and be my age and have been from one coast to the other is pretty impressive, because that's what a lot of people would do if they were retired. So I feel very blessed to be able to do that. And, you know, my wife is a school teacher, so she gets to spend a lot of time in the summer months traveling with
her.
So that's made it really enjoyable.
So let's talk about your home lake. What is that specifically? What do you consider your home lake?
Well, I'm about 15 minutes from the Table Rock.
Okay.
So live really close to Table Rock. And, you know, it was kind of one of those lakes that was very similar to where I grew up in California fishing. You know, I lived where I fished against Aaron Martins a lot. We fished the southern Lake Castaic, Casitas, Kachuma, Lopez. You know, Jared Lintner lives on Lopez. So that's kind of where I cut my teeth, in those deep, rocky, clear environments. We had a lot of championships where we would travel up north to, say, the California Delta or Clear Lake. But majority of my fishing was deep, clear, rocky lakes. And that's very similar to what Table Rock is.
Absolutely. So how are we doing on numbers?
We're good. I want to go into Brian's history with Bassmaster. And first note that he's an original Elite Series member. Started fishing the Elites in 2006. And so you've, right?
Yeah, you can go back farther than that.
Well,
I actually
right.
started when it was the top 150s.
Top 150s, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So just speaking of when the Elite Series was formed, so 13 years on the Elite Series. This will be your 14th season as an Elite Series angler. So you got a lot of history with Bassmaster. It's a total of 193 tournaments. Mm. And I should note that he's a fairly recent Million Dollar Club member.
I was thinking last year, right?
Yeah, that's the last tournament last year.
Well,
tournament of the year.
Sitting at a table with three guys who are never going to know what it's like to win $1 million fishing. Tell us what that was like to go over that milestone.
Well, you know, it kind of snuck up on me. I really was just trying to continue to move up in Angler of the Year standings, have a good finish, get that last check of the year. And I knew it was the last check that I needed to make that $1 million mark. And, you know, it's kind of a feeling of satisfaction that you've had a career where you've been able to be that prosperous.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It's not like you just got $1 million check, though. I mean, that's over a career, so.
That's over a lot of times. So you can do the math if you wanted to do it by the years. You know, it's taken a little while. There's been some ups and downs where we could have really jumped that up quicker. But
it's an elite club, though.
It is a very elite
club. Yeah, it is. And it's a small group.
And, you know, so I'm very proud to be a part of that group with the anglers that I share that with.
That's great. His first tournament as a on the Bassmaster Series was 1999. Okay, that was a Central Invitational, mm-hmm. Lake of the Ozarks, and you started strong, 15th place.
15th place.
Do you remember that tournament?
I don't. I remember the one I tied for with Todd Fairclough.
Okay.
Ended up, I think, finishing second in that
one. Which one was that?
It might have been the year after.
That was 2001.
Okay, 2001.
Lake of the Ozarks.
I think it was a cold November tournament.
Okay.
Yeah.
So 193 tournaments, 6 classics, okay? 107 times in the money. Mm-hmm. So don't have my calculator nearby, but 193 tournaments, 107 times in the money. That's a pretty good percentage.
That is a good percentage.
Particularly when you go that length of time. Mm-hmm. We'll see some guys with a really high percentage that have 2 years or 5 years or something like that. But when you talk about a full, mm-hmm. more of a full-blown career, that's a strong number.
Well, you're making me feel good.
So congratulations.
Well, it is. Yeah. We see, you know, we've crossed a lot of these numbers, and we don't see very many anglers that carry a 50% or stronger average to finish in the checks. There are a few, obviously, in the shorter career spans, right. I think we're kind of putting an asterisk by, but to have that many years in and carry a 50% or stronger, that's certainly above average.
Right.
Is that a philosophical thing for you? Are there tournaments where you are aiming for a check? I mean,
Yes, there definitely is. And you know, the expenses just, you know, we have such great expenses and traveling all over the United States, the entry fees and all that. When you combine all that, the checks are very important for me as an individual to be able to make checks 50% of the time, make sure I can be out there the following year.
Mm-hmm.
It makes, you know, I have a comfortable living, and then I can go ahead and, you know, maintain my lifestyle and move on to the next year. The last few years, it's been a while since I felt like I could win, but there's been a few times where I was just, you know, in the position to try and get a check because I wasn't on anything enough to move up any further.
Right. And I would think coming away with a $10,000
paycheck
in that situation is...
You feel like that's a victory in itself because you know that allows you to continue on and, you know, continue your fishing career. Because, you know, a lot of times the longevity, that comes with that consistency. And that's mm-hmm. one of the reasons why I've always tried to maintain the 50 to 60% average on your paycheck.
When does it happen? Is there a moment in practice? Does it happen during an event, early in the event, when you realize this is not going to be a check tournament? I'm going to go and swing for the fences.
A lot of times it's the body of water. A lot of times I'll feel more comfortable with a place versus another place. So, you know, Florida, for some reason, I don't know why, has always been really good to me for the most part. St. John's River's kind of a thorn in my side, but the other places in Florida do real well. Places like Lanier and Cherokee that fish similar to what I'm really accustomed to, I expect to do good on those.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes when you go into one, you're planning on doing well, because of the type of environment you'll be fishing in. And then some of the others, you're hoping to do well enough to get a check.
Right.
Sometimes they surprise you. Sometimes, you know, it doesn't. But
sure.
That's kind of the way you look at it. You get excited about certain ones. You really feel like you should capitalize on those.
Right.
So we've got, going down your list a little bit further, we got 4 second place finishes. We mm-hmm. just mentioned one of them, that first one, 2001, Lake of the Ozarks. Your second place finish was 2005. That was Louisville Lake, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And your third second place finish was a 2007 major. That was High Rock Lake in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And your fourth was in 2008. That was Harris Chain. In Florida.
That one hurt.
Is that right? Tell us about that one.
Well, you know, that one... A couple of the other ones, we were doing the whole course, you know, so some of them had a substantial lead before they zeroed the weights and moved us to a different body of water. Those kind of sit a little easier because it wasn't under my control when we changed the venue kind of changed the pattern, changed the style of fishing we were doing. The one that hurts was the one at Toho, just because it was 4 days, same body of water, and you know, I had a pretty strong lead going into the last day, and I hadn't spent much time in the area that I'd been catching them in, you know, a couple hours each day to catch the weight I had caught. So I was really excited, except for the massive cold front and the winds blowing 30 to 40 miles an hour out of the north in Florida. It was a very shallow area that I was fishing, 2-3 feet. And I guess it just, you know, when I put the trolling motor down and the water was 10 degrees colder, I was like, wow. Oh, my goodness.
Wow, that's huge.
Yeah, that's
we had to lay down. The camera gentleman, I think it was Brian, I believe, he and I laid down on the floor, and it was a trolling motor only area, and we had to troll the motor in because the wind was so strong, laying on the bottom of the deck of the boat.
Wow.
To get in there with this 40 mile an hour wind. But once we got back in there, it calmed down enough where you could fish, you know, fairly effectively. And, you know, the show kind of showed it as me losing fish, and it, you know, the time lapse, I want people to know it was like 4 hours or 5 hours before I got a bite. So the water had finally started to warm up a little bit later in the day. And then to lose the 2 or 3 fish that you actually saw that were 4 to 6 pounds, and you knew those were the fish that you needed to win. But, you know, it was just those things that it was frustrating because you waited so long to get the bite. And then, you know, kind of the TV show kind of showed it where it was a little, almost might seem quicker, where I lost some fish and then lost my composure a little bit. And I just kind of wanted people to know that it was a long time before those first bites occurred. And then when the first bites did occur, I tried several different ways, you know, letting the fish swim, you know, because the first one I set normal real quick. Thought, well, maybe it was just, you know, they're lethargic, they're not getting the bait, there are a lot of spawning fish in this area. So I'd wait, and, you know, you could see on the next one, he swims 10 feet before I set the hook, and he still gets off.
Wow.
And then to lose a 6-pounder that wraps up around like one reed. You know, you got a 25-pound XPS fluorocarbon, you're flipping with an 8-foot St. Croix heavy action rod, and you hit this fish with everything you can, move him, he wraps around one twig, you can't break it, you go over there to get him, and as soon as you get ready to bend over to lip him, the fish comes off.
Wow, I'd be frustrated.
Yeah, I said a few choice words, which I probably shouldn't have, but you know, they aired it a lot. Seems to like it.
So, one of the things I find fascinating is you get into a lot of these situations, you know, even we talk to an angler of the year, or somebody that got second to angler of the year, and they can trace back their entire season to one decision. Is there something in that tournament you should have done differently, or was it straight the weather just... out of nowhere.
It was definitely the weather, but it was not adjusting quick enough to that weather change. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to know when to stay or go, and that's always the $100,000 question when we're at these events. Everyone's capable of finding fish and catching fish, but it's what you do in that 8 hours that you have, what decision you make. And if I had to do it over again, I would have switched it up. I would have fished in maybe one of the rivers going into Griffin. I would have fished a little bit of deeper water, similar to what Mike McClellan did to win. And, you know, you can watch the video and say, yeah, I should have done that.
It's easy to Monday morning quarterback.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you got to go with what you believe in. And when you get an 8 or 9 pound lead, sometimes I think that kind of hurts because you're not willing to change as much because you have such a good lead. You're like, one or two fish and I've got this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know.
4 hours later.
Yeah.
Talking about decisions that affected big events, you had a third place classic finish in 2009 and I think lost by less than 2 pounds. What were there moments during that event that you think back, boy, I could have been a classic winner?
Not really, because the not to go into a real negative situation, but I had motor trouble the last day, lost a lower unit.
Really?
So wow. I only had about 4 hours to fish that day. And I was sharing the water with a gentleman, a good friend of mine that was in the same area. And he had been there kind of the same situation. It was in the springtime. Water had cooled off some. Water had started to warm. So he had been there, and he was actually in first place going into the last day, Jamie Fralick. And he had no fish when I arrived. So to come in there and then catch what I caught, had a good stringer the last day. In this short amount of time, you know, maybe I was doing something a little different with my lure than he was to catch those fish. I might have caught some sooner, but it definitely wasn't lights out first thing in the morning that I missed because of the lower unit.
Right.
You know, the service crew was great, but I was already locked down when it happened. And what was terrible is I was like a quarter of a mile from the lock, but I was
already
through it. Oh, wow. So there's no place to go except Main River. And all I'm doing is waiting for the backup boat to come get me. And, you know, by the time they got there and me, you know, having to get down there and then lock back up at a certain time, it really shortened the day. But I didn't lose any fish, so I really couldn't say if I had more time it would have been better or worse. But I would have loved to have had those 4 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
So you've had 17 top 10s. Don't know if you know these numbers. 17 top 10s, 31 top 20s. 56 top 30s.
Wow.
That's pretty good.
That is good.
56 top 30s out of 193 tournaments. Again, that's strong. So let's look at your 2018 elite season. And, of course, started at Lake Martin. I'm going to run through these really quick. But okay. You stop me if you want to bring up anything about any of these tournaments in particular. Lake Martin, you had a 46, made a check. Second tournament of the year at Grand Lake, finished 37th. Again, make a check.
Now, that one I think I could have done a little better.
Okay.
I had lost some fish that week and didn't really adjust well to what I ended up doing for the last couple days. But it was one that I was very excited about. Kind of let me down because, you know, I thought I could get in the top 12.
Yeah, yeah. That's not too far from home for you, I guess.
No, I fished there quite regularly. But in practice, I was just on the edge of figuring out what to do. And I thought I had a good opportunity to make a top 12, if not even move further up. So that one was kind of disappointing.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt. Next two tournaments back-to-back, or they weren't back-to-back, but you had the same finish in both. the Kentucky Lake Tournament, a 96, and then a 96 at Lake Travis in Texas as well. And those stood out in your year because otherwise you were pretty consistently below the cut and had a pretty good year. But those two tournaments hurt you.
They hurt me bad. And that's the first time I think it's first time I've not made a top 12 at Kentucky.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But it was a different time of the year.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of different things going on mm-hmm. other than what I normally do. If, you know, I think I can hold my own with anyone when we go out there and ride around and look for fish on the ledges. That's one of the things I love to do. And Kentucky's always been really, really good to me for doing that. I just could not find them out there. I spent too much time out there looking for them.
Mm-hmm.
Found a couple areas that I caught a few fish on, and I actually caught a few in the tournament out, but I just could not make it work. And the places I normally catch them, they just weren't there yet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, yeah, it was a bum deal because it was one of those we talked about earlier about being excited about, and Kentucky was definitely one of them. I was, you know, a little concerned about it being too early, and it definitely was for what I like to do.
So after Travis, we go down to Sabine, challenging fishery for most guys. You finished 32nd there, another cut.
Yeah. That was a good one, I think I had found some definitely top 12 fish, if not winning. We just had to share them with about 9 other boats.
Okay. That's the challenge.
You know, and there was like one of the top 12 was in there, and several guys right around the same place that I was. So we definitely found a great area. There was just too many of us in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Never hear that about the Sabine.
Yeah. But I thought it fished. Didn't you guys think it fished pretty good this time for being in the time of year?
And only having the one side, the Texas side of the river.
It was a dramatic tournament to follow.
It was definitely a lot better than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, it was an exciting tournament. Mm-hmm. I know it's not the favorite of some, but it was a really compelling tournament, and you're right. A lot of guys did better than expected. After that, we go up north, went to La Crosse. You had a 59, close to a cut.
Yeah, that La Crosse, it is not it's another one that I just can't quite understand. I miss, you know, I'm 52nd, 53rd, 60th,
yeah.
50, and I don't really know why, because, you know, I like to flip. There's a lot of flipping. I can throw a frog fairly good. I catch them on table rock when they're at something, you know. So I'm accustomed to doing that. It's just I always seem to find the 2.5 instead of the 2.75 to 3.5. And so that one's always really bothered me when we go up there.
We'll probably go back.
We'll probably have
another chance.
I think I'm going to scrap where I go and just go to a different pool.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to do something new.
It's a lot of water up there.
Break it up.
And it all looks great. That's the problem. It's got grass, lily pads.
Really easy.
That's got to be real similar to Florida, though, isn't it? I mean, think about Harris Chain and even St. John's. There's a lot of similar looking areas.
Yeah, but it just doesn't seem to fish the same. They're so current related out there. And, you know, the Florida fish, I think the reason why I do well there is being able to fish real slow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the slow plastic presentation, it just works in Florida, yep. And I can drown a bait real well.
So we go from there up to South Dakota. Had you fished at there, fished at Oahe at all?
Never been there.
Okay. 49th place finish there.
Yeah, just squeaked in.
Make another check.
Make another check.
And then really finish the year strong with your best finish at St. Lawrence, 23rd place there.
And that's, you can talk about decision making. The first day probably cost me from making the top 12. Had a slow morning on smallmouth, and I probably should have known better. It was a little overcast that morning, a little bit of wind. I wasn't patient enough, so I decided by 10:30, you know, I have like one fish in the boat. I said, I need to have a limit. I need to catch largemouth. And ended up weighing in two or three of those largemouth because one of them was a 5 and the other one was a 4. Caught a limit real quick on this largemouth stuff, but then finally settled down and figured out a little bit more on the smallmouth stuff, and my weights improved each time.
Okay.
I think the largest string of the third day. So the first day is what cost me, and that was the decision thing. I probably made the wrong decision with not being patient enough with the smallmouth, because the last day I fished the same area as the first day, and everywhere you went you caught a 5 pound.
Wow. Well, you had nearly 63 pounds for 3 days of fishing. Boy, I'm telling you, you know, over 20 pounds a day, 21 pounds a day, and in 23rd place shows the weights that deal were really strong.
Were you as surprised as everybody else seemed to be about that day one? We had 52 20-pound-plus bags of smallmouth.
Yeah, I think I had like 18 or 19 pounds of largemouth and was in like 70th place. And
what do you do?
Yeah, the first year we were there, I had 19.8 and was in top 10. So I think the smallmouth have actually gained some weight. I think they're weighing a lot bigger, and the population of them just seems to be greater. I mean, it doesn't matter shallow or deep.
Right, right. So that ends up the year for a very respectable 59th place in AOI. So you weren't far off.
Well, you get rid of the ones where I got like 6 points or something in two events. So
yeah,
you know, those definitely caution. With this group of anglers, you can't afford those 90s. You just can't. And that's why you have to grin and bear it. And I was hoping to maybe break into the top 50. If we probably, you know, who knows what would happen at Chesapeake Bay, but I was needing that event to try and shave off some more.
Right.
To get to that angular.
Yeah, totally understand.
Well, it's an up and down game, but it all starts somewhere. And I want to go back to your early days, and you'd mentioned that you knew what you wanted to do early on, and you'd pursued that. But when you were a kid, was that were you following tournament world? Were you interested in it, or was it just a love to go fishing?
Well, we love to go fishing. Luckily, my grandparents they had a ranch that they had with a farm pond in California, and we would do that a lot, just fish off the bank and stuff. But I saw it on TV in high school, the Bassmasters, and I can remember watching the shows and thinking, my gosh, that's a great way to make a living. You get to fish and travel around to all these great places. And so in high school was really when I started leaning more toward it as a career. You know, I was very involved with football, played high school football and was on the swim team. As I moved forward, you know, football went away first. I continued to swim. And then the tournaments just got to where I would go on the weekends, had to miss swim meets. So I started my senior year where that was all I did was the fishing. And I was very fortunate. I had some real good teachers out in California. You know, my dad would go with me in our club tournaments and stuff, but I had another gentleman, I had two gentlemen that would take me when I was 16, and I would be their co-angler, non-boater, and we had a draw circuit, West Coast Pro-Am, and so I got to fish with a lot of the guys in the back of the boat when I was still in high school.
You know, we've talked to some other anglers that mentioned the value of being a co-angler early on, and I'm trying to recall who we spoke to earlier, but did not do the co-angler route and really wished he had. Talk about why that's a valuable aspect to learning.
Everyone's got different styles of the way they do things. It doesn't matter if it's throwing a spinnerbait, working a jig, or a topwater. Everyone's got their own little things they do, and when you get to experience that in the back of their boat during tournament conditions, they're trying everything they can to do well in that tournament, so they're not holding any information back. It allows you to get a good perspective from a lot of different people mm-hmm. of how to catch fish. And I did that for 3 or 4 years in California. And then when I moved to the Midwest in Missouri, I was in a club and also in the what they used to have, the Central Pro-Ams, which was a big circuit, 150 boat Pro-Am format. We would do Missouri, Oklahoma, and Arkansas. And while I was in college, I couldn't afford the boats and all that, so I just would go. The gentleman would let me ride with them and practice with them on Friday, and then I could fish the event with two other different gentlemen for the 2 days, Saturday and Sunday. So I think the learning curve, when you start going with 20 or 30 different individuals per year, you start getting bits and pieces of what they do and apply it to the way you like to do things.
Is there something that you can gather from fishing behind somebody?
Well, you definitely have to change up a little bit. I watch retrieves. I would watch what they were throwing, colors, different weights. They might be throwing, say they were flipping a half-ounce jig around boat docks. I'd come in with something like a 16th or an 8th-ounce, wacky rig Cinco or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that style of bait to use. And just to mix it up and give the fish a little different look, crankbaits. They might be burning that crankbait. I'd use more of a stop and go, something of that nature, to try and trigger different fish.
That's an interesting way to approach it. So everybody was supportive for your dream, I'm assuming. Nobody tried to tell you to go get a real job and be smart about things?
No, I was very fortunate. My parents were behind me 100%. The only arrangement we had was college. Mm-hmm. I had to graduate college before I could try and pursue it. And
you decided to move to the Midwest to pursue the fishing career.
Right. Now, there was only one Bass Pro, and that was going to be my sponsor, so that's where I had to go. Mm-hmm. And it was great. I got to work for him part-time through college. You know how college life is. You just need enough money to survive.
That's right.
So I'm going to school and working for them, but I'm also getting to know the correct people, mm-hmm. the people in charge of the pro staff and things like that. So it allowed me to open some doors.
The parents offering their support based on you getting a college degree, that's a fair deal.
That is a pretty fair deal.
Everybody out there listening, not these young
people. Yeah, it was a very fair, and my mom and dad have been fantastic about the whole fishing as a career, and my dad was very supportive. Sometimes he gets on me and need to do a little better.
one question for you from your youth. On your angler survey, you listed that you worked for you were groundskeeper for the California Cemetery Department. That's the first time I've seen that show up on
the Cemetery Department. Guess I didn't know there was a
department. Is it like public cemeteries or something?
Uh-huh. Yeah. They have a. It was it was a part time job through the summer months. It was full time, but it was only during the summer, and it was quite the experience. I got to learn how to do the grave digging machine. We would prep for an actual funeral. You'd lower the grave, you lower the coffin into the grave. You'd have to put the dirt on the top. You'd have to deal with the people that came out for setup, all the lawn and maintenance of the grounds, and all the equipment.
That's great.
Very important.
Yeah,
it is. Unsung hero.
That's special.
And it was also sometimes very hard. A few of my classmates, they passed away during the school year that we were out there. And then there was one mother that I remember vividly, that she would always come, and her child had died. So she would always put the toys.
Oh, yeah.
And we would remove the toys, but she would always come out the next day and rearrange the toys back for the child.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that's, it's a little hard when you're that age to see that every
right.
day.
Right, right. But introduce you to the realities of life mm-hmm. for everybody.
Well, another question we like to ask, and this is, some people like there was no other option, and I'm assuming this will be the same for you, but if you were to pursue a different career, or if there was going to be a different road for you, what do you think it may have been? Considering your degree, maybe.
I would definitely like to do research. It's something in fisheries management with the research aspect of it, to make either the fish population better in the United States or control of the environment of, say, a table rock, mm-hmm. where you're trying to make that a better fishery for everyone. you know, we had a lot of emphasis in the time I was going to school with the aquaculture as well as the fish hatcheries. So probably something along those lines where you were dealing with either raising fish for sale or also raising fish for stocking in public water.
So fish was going to be a part of the equation no matter what.
Right. They've always been kind of a special love with the fish.
So for your pro fishermen, your biologists, there are other pro fishermen living in this neighborhood of yours. I'm just wondering, is there a nondescript pond in this neighborhood that has more fish in it than it should ever have?
I think he's asking for an invite.
Yeah. I'm just curious.
We're going to keep that a secret, but there is a very good one right up in our area.
There usually is in that situation.
There's a reason why.
Yeah. And we try and keep it hush-hush.
Yeah.
I can blindfold you if you'd like to.
Take that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, let's go.
One other tournament detail that I skipped over, you won the Toyota Texas Bass Classic Championship.
I did.
What year was that?
Ooh, it's been a few years back, I think 10 or 11.
Okay, and that's the event that became our Bass Fest.
Correct.
Yeah, boy, that's a great one to win.
It sure is.
It was definitely a career helper. You know, and in that event, I'd gotten a second and like four top tens in the one at Conroe.
And what fishery was that on?
Conroe.
That's Conroe. Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's another structure lake.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of docks, too, so it kind of fits my style. You can structure fish. You can fish for suspended fish around boat docks a lot. So it was right up my wheelhouse. And, you know, over the time, you could see that with the seconds and eighth and stuff like that when we were down there. So I was very fortunate. And, you know, that was always one of those tournaments that was really great to be a part of, to qualify, be there.
Right.
And it was one that, you know, you had the best of everyone.
Right.
When you'd win that.
Yeah, that was and continues to be a great, great tournament, great great organization with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, Toyota's involvement.
Right, and all the benefits that it's done for the community, for getting kids involved in fishing, as well as for fish habitat for Texas Parks and Wildlife.
Right, right.
So across your career, it's longer than I realize. It's impressive. But I'm sure you've seen a lot of big changes, a lot of things come and go. Talk about something, maybe pick one thing out that you're, I guess, impressed by or something that has surprised you. Maybe it's a technological advancement or something, but over the change of your career, or the time of your career, what change really stands out to you?
Electronics. I mean, being able to see a fish move to a lure that's 70 feet in front of you with your pan, you know, with Garmin LiveScope, it's amazing. I mean, all they have left to do now is be able to tell you if it's a bass or a crappie or a walleye.
little icon that shows up.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that? I mean, I've had a little bit of time with the live scope, not a ton to be real confident with it. But is there a point where it gets frustrating where you see the fish there, your lure's there, and it just has to open its mouth and act like it needs to eat something? Is there a point where you're like, come on?
Yeah, sometimes, you know, at Table Rock, we fish a lot of deep, and you'll be like, how can I not even snag him on that?
Right.
You know, you'll be jigging your spoon, and you're like, how in the world does this happen? You know, the best thing is, an example I can tell you with the live scope, there was a cedar tree. First time I was using it, I was throwing a suspending jerkbait, and I would watch the jerkbait come by, just getting the feel for how it all worked, and I saw this little mark come out, and it followed it a little bit, and then turned around and went back to the tree. Took four casts. He had come out a little further each time. Fourth cast caught him.
Huh.
Wow.
3.5 pound.
Wow.
Largemouth. But that just it went to show me that the technology, I would have never, ever caught that fish because I would have never thrown that many times. But to be able to see those fish, coax them, see how they react. I was out a couple days ago on Table Rock, and I watched one with the down live scope where you can, you know, maneuver it where it just goes straight down. We're deep fishing over deep trees. And I watched one come 30 feet from the right side all the way across the center to the gentleman that was fishing with me on the left side and then attack his lure.
Man, that's impressive.
That's
great. A long ways.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, the deeper you go, the wider that angle is. And you could see that fish way before you saw it on the traditional 2D sonar. So the advancements with, you know, you got side view, down view, the amount of water we can cover thoroughly is 10 times greater now than it was 5 years ago.
Wow.
And I can only imagine what the technology is going to be like in the next 5 years.
Do you feel like your time before electronics really took off, where you were, you know, I guess in today's day and age, we can call it old school. Did that time help you become more effective with your modern electronics?
It definitely did. And also one of the things that a lot of people forget because of modern electronics with like GPS and positioning is to use landmarks. I still use landmarks because no matter how accurate the GPS is, you still have to have something to throw to make that exact same cast time and time again. So I still use and incorporate a lot of old school triangulation when I use
the GPS. Notebook and pencil.
Notebook and pencil. Now it's a waypoint, and you know I use the pointer, which extends off the front of my boat where you can kind of see what you know how far it is away. But I still want to have that landmark to visually make that cast.
There's a trend on the Elite series that we've started paying attention to this year, and because there's more this year, but there's more business owners that that are fishing the Elite series. When you look at guys like Gary Klaus, and we're talking
Dale Hightower,
Jesse Tacarante, Cliff Prince, and I see that you own a storage facility.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
I've heard, and I have tried to talk my dad into building some storage units. They just seem to me like they'd be a cash cow. Maybe I'm wrong, but.
Well, you do deal with the public, so you know you have to.
We all know that's not my strong suit. So,
it has been very good. Now, you guys, I'm very new to this. I purchased the property in April, and I finished construction on it in June. But it's already cash flowed itself and almost full.
Wow.
Unfortunately,
good move.
Yeah,
we're going to put you into our new group of business owners that have some unique challenges and something going on at home that they have to pay attention to.
Well, you know, the nice thing about the storage facility is with technology and gate codes, and it's got all that entry, and I can do most of it on the road. I can be practicing and rent a unit, provide them with a code or access code to the facility, tell them what unit to go to, and charge their credit card while I'm on the water.
Wow.
So it's a business that is, once the initial building was done and completed and I kind of got the hang of it, it's a minimal time investment for your return. Most of the people are excellent to deal with. I do all the expansion to the facility was for boats and RVs. Being close to Table Rock Lake, I felt that was the best thing to have.
Smart.
And, you know, so I've got big enclosures for boats and RVs and some outdoor parking as well as some of the, there was two original buildings that have some smaller units and those kind of things. But, you know, if anyone wants a storage unit that comes to Table Rock, you know, Wellspring Storage, you're more than welcome to look us up online or give me a call.
And do you still guide any?
I do some, mainly with return customers that I've had for years and years, but I do guide on Table Rock Lake.
Okay.
Any plans to expand the storage unit already?
There has been talk, but you know, again, it's the initial investment, and I think I'm going to kind of wait a while. There's a piece of property right across the street that's for sale.
You looking for a partner?
I might be.
Well, you know, we like to wrap these shows up kind of digging into something you would say to the next generation, and that might be a young angler, it might be an older angler, a 40-something angler that has waited a while to take the plunge. You know, you finished college, you knew what you were going to do right away, but you know, everybody has a different path to where they're at. So if you're going to advise somebody as far as pursuing the dream to eventually become a professional top-level angler, what would you say to them?
Definitely take the time to build up good relationships with sponsors. Try and work that angle the best you can because it's the consistent income that you definitely need to maintain a career in this sport.
Very good. A lot of good thoughts. So we've had a lot of fun here. We got to dig into Brian Snowden, and we got to hear about your past, your history as an angler. It's a long history. I don't mean to make you feel old, but surprised at the number of tournaments.
Well, you know, you start right out of college and been fishing the Opens and the Elites ever since.
All right, one last question. How important is a great beard to being successful on the water?
I only have them in the wintertime. So maybe, you know, we'll see. I might do it for Florida, and if that turns out good, I might keep it all year.
I don't know. Brasher, you going to grow one this year?
He could disappear forever. Look at his mugshot on the website. Look at it now and tell me this is the
It's a
guy.
Very different looking guy.
It's a good beard, though.
I'm impressed.
Jim was working on a mustache till a couple days ago.
Still am. You just can't tell.
Hey, this has been a fun time. This is Inside Bassmaster. You have listened to Brian Brasher, Jim Sexton, Brian Snowden. This has been Thomas Allen. We'll catch you here next time.